My name's Sonia, and I'm an alcoholic. And guys, it's so much fun, I want to play with it too. All right. Not good. I have never been accused of being quiet, so this will take a minute. How's that? Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Good. Well, first of all, I'd like to thank the committee for having me here today. Don't worry about that one. Okay, good. All right. I can't concentrate on anything. This microphone is the least of my problems. I want to thank the committee for inviting me here today. What a wonderful conference, and your love and your outpouring of welcome have just been terrific. You've just made me feel really welcome. I want to especially thank Mike, who I felt like I knew before I got here after all our conversations on the phone. And Mary and Jerry, the co-chairs, who've just done a fabulous job, and all the other people who've made me feel so welcome. Wonderful meeting that Kim shared this afternoon. It's good to see Patty O again. Nice to see Fred from Massachusetts. A year ago, I was doing some work in Reno, Nevada, and I didn't know a soul, and I was there for 26 weeks, and I attended a conference they were having there, and Fred was there, and he made me feel so welcome. I thought he was from Reno. And I especially want to welcome Russ and Scott, Lisa and Roxanne, and any other newcomers that might be here that didn't announce yourselves tonight. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I sure hope you find here what I've found here, because it's been a whole new life for me. The reason I'm up here tonight isn't because I'm special. If you haven't been to a lot of conferences, I think I'm special. That's still not why I'm here. I'm here to share my experience, strength, and hope, because this program's given me a life I never had before. And when I came here, what I thought was is that if I could drink a little bit less, my life might get a little bit better. And what I found out when I got here was that if you could teach me a little bit about how to live one day at a time, I wouldn't have to drink anymore. So for those of you who are new, my message of hope is that I walked into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous on my sobriety date, July 11th, 1986, and I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since that time. And for that, I'm really grateful. Miracles Happen is a great name for your conference, because that's how I feel about Alcoholics Anonymous in my life. Let me tell you a little bit about the journey that got me here, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. I was actually born in Northern California in a small town called Chico. Little did I know I was destined to be a successful alcoholic there. It was the number one party school in the nation, and I was just born there by accident. So I didn't even have to move. I was born a twin. I wasn't the good twin. Suffice it to say, my sister was one there. I think there's one in every family, but you know, she was the one that always dressed nicely, always said please and thank you, did the right thing, got the good grades in school, and told on the other one. And my parents were pretty much at the time, I thought, were pretty much a normal family. I didn't have anything to compare it to, you know. I know today we talk a lot about dysfunctional homes, and I didn't think I was from one. You know, my dad is what I call a regular drinker. He drinks about a half a fifth of scotch a day, and has for a long time. And his mark of a good man is one that can hold his liquor. You know, and his definition of an alcoholic when I was growing up is, well, he didn't know what one was, but he knew what one wasn't. If you could get up every morning and shave and shower and go to work, you weren't one. And what you did the rest of the time was okay. And that's how I grew up, and that's one of the reasons I didn't get here any sooner, I believe, is that alcohol was never my problem. For many, many years, I got up, I skipped the shave, I went ahead and showered and went to work. And I thought my dad was a pretty cool guy, you know. He was always the life of the party. We all love the alcoholic, really, you know, until this little turning point happens. But he was the life of the party. And, you know, and he was one of those guys at the dance that everyone else's wife would say, Boy, you're lucky that's your dad. Boy, she's lucky that's her husband. You know, and they were never the ones that had to be at home with them. And what I thought about my mom was that she was nuts. I mean, she was the one that embarrassed me. She was the one that was always yelling and screaming and, you know, not wanting the neighbors to know. That was sort of the definition of our family, you know. Don't let the neighbors know. We didn't talk about what went on inside the house. We were a demonstrative family. I know on one occasion, my dad said, we were all at the dinner table. We had lively discussions at the dinner table, and my dad said, you open your mouth one more time. And so I opened my mouth. I just went, boom. And he had the longest arm. He reached all the way across the table and nailed me, you know, and that wasn't unexpected. I just didn't duck quick enough. And I'm bleeding, and my nose is bleeding, and my mouth's bleeding. I had this just moment of insanity, and I ran for the front door and started down the street to yell about what he did, and three members of my own family tackled me and dragged me back in the house. See, that was the definition of unacceptable behavior. I didn't think my mom had a drinking problem. Twice during the time I was growing up, she was away from the home for about a year in a sanitarium. You know, at that time, you know, women alcoholics really weren't recognized as we should be. And so what they did then is they put people like that, you know, they called them nervous breakdowns, and they put them someplace else for a while, and then they came back and they were better for a while. And so I never knew until well into adulthood that my mother had a drinking problem. I just thought she was the one ragging on the rest of us all the time. And amongst all that, there's a very special person that ended up shaping my life for a long time, and that was my grandfather. And my grandfather was the stabilizing force for me. He was an upstanding member of the community. He lived across town. He was a leader in his church. He did a lot of civic duty. And one time I was talking to him. He was where I went after school. When I got out of school, I'd go over to his house, and he was always wonderful to me, and he always treated me with kindness, and he always hugged me, and he did all the things no one else in my family did, you know, and served me snacks and did stuff like that. And one time I asked him, I said, why is everybody, something had happened, one of those normal things, you know, we'd broken all the dishes after dinner, but we didn't all break them. My mother threw them at my father, and they broke. And so I said, what is the deal here? You know, now we don't have any dishes. And my granddad said, well, you know, some people have a little trouble when they drink. And I said, well, Grandpa, you don't drink. Is that why you're so nice? And he said, well, I said, have you ever drank? And he said, well, yes, I did. He said, I drank a lot as a young man. And he said, what I found out was that when I drank, I had a problem with my personality. And he said, so at 18, when I met your grandmother and fell in love, I asked for God to help me out. And he said, and I quit drinking so I could have a life. And that was before the start of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it says in our books that we're not the only path, that we don't have the market cornered. And he was one of the few people that, in my opinion, recovered another way. And he was an example in my life, and he was a force of love. Now that I've told you about all of them, we get to the tough part. I'll have to tell you about me. As a small child, I stammered badly. I had a hard time communicating. I was the exact opposite of my sister. I wanted to do so good, and the more I wanted to do good, the less well I did. And I could do things at home, and I'd get to school, and I'd freeze up, and I couldn't do them. And I was disruptive, And you know, kids aren't the kindest thing in the world. When you stammer at school and they laugh, you're forced to straighten them out, you know. So I got in a lot of fights. And so the school sent me home. My parents, you know, they didn't want that kind of thing to happen. And I'd come home and I'd be having these things that, a lot like we call tantrums. And my parents would give me brandy and I'd calm down. Then they started thinking, well, you know, if they gave me brandy before I went to school, probably the day would go better. Now, today, we don't think of this as an appropriate treatment, you know, but what choice did they have then? I mean, we were pre-Ritalin. And so one thing I want to make really clear about this is that my drinking began as it ended for medicinal purposes. And the fact that my parents gave me brandy before I went to school has absolutely nothing to do with the coincidence that I'm an alcoholic today. I just feel like I had a happier childhood than most kids. And I was a poor student. You know, they'd call my parents in and say, you know, don't compare her with her twin sister. She's probably an overachiever just to get C's. And, you know, my mother would come home and ask me what bullshit I was giving them now. And but I didn't do well in school. And I didn't do well in school until I got a little motivation. And that was when my granddad sat me on his knee and he said, listen, now I was in ninth grade. And he said, you see that car out there on the curb? And I said, uh-huh. He said, well, he said, you get straight A's from now until you're 16, and that car's yours. And at that time, no one in high school had a car. And I got straight A's right till then. I mean, isn't that just like the alcoholic? You know, I quit using alcohol medicinally, according to my parents, when I was in junior high, but I decided for the preservation of all around me that I should self-medicate through high school. And so I did. And I don't believe that ever interfered with my studies. And that's how I saw it then. So that I drank a little bit so that I wouldn't stutter, so I could be good in school, and so I could get those A's and get that car. That's what this was all about. When I was 16, I got the car, and then I started partying. And I was mostly a loner. I didn't have a lot of friends. When I had a friend, I always had one friend. And this wasn't a trend that just started in high school and passed. Until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I only had one friend at a time. I may have a few acquaintances. There were times I had no friends. But, you know, when you're taking hostages, it takes a lot of energy to keep track of them. And I couldn't trust that person with anybody else because they might tell somebody something else I didn't want them to know. Because here's what I did. I tried to figure out what you wanted, and that's what I tried to be. And so if any two people got together, I was so paranoid that as a young adult, I would look across the room, see two people I knew, and absolutely know they were talking about me at a party. Now, I'm not that interesting. Yeah? But that's how my mind worked. When I was 16 years of age, everything's pretty normal up to then. And when I was 16, my grandfather died. And even though at that time I could tell you drinking didn't interfere with anything for me in high school, my grandfather's death was the most tragic event of my life because he was the only love, the only consistency that I'd ever known. And when he died, I so much wanted to do the right thing. He was the person, if I could have ever been like anyone when I grew up, I mean, he was my idea of a saint. And I wanted to go to his funeral, you know, but I cared about him so much I didn't want to screw up because toughness was really prized in my family. My dad had been in the military and we could bounce quarters off our beds and, you know, we misbehaved, we stood at attention and, you know, if we gained 2 pounds, we ran around the block a few times and, you know, that's sort of how it was. So I didn't want to cry at the funeral and I didn't want to screw up. So I had a few drinks to get ready for that funeral, and the short part of that story is I was never at that funeral, you know, because I spent too much time getting ready. And when I was 18, I had excelled in school. By that point, I had gone from not doing anything to being a really good student, and I'd made it clear to the state championships of the debates. And the weekend before the debates, some older kids in college had invited me out to a picnic. And at that picnic, you know, they opened beers and they put the vodka in the beer and they served some, you know, all the stuff you serve at pickles and different picnic foods. And, man, I tasted that beer and it had that vodka in it and it went down and I was just, it was one of the few times I could be with more than one person. It was one of the few times that I really felt like one of the group. And so I did that some more, and I ended up just getting terribly, terribly sick. I ran into a tree. I got a severe concussion. I was walking. And, God, they put me in the back of this truck, and they took me home. And my dad had always said, you know, it's a deal about holding your liquor. If you ever come home drunk, by God, you'll never come home again. And I'll tell you how true this is. My brother was 8 years younger than me, and when he was 16 years old, he came home drunk. My parents threw him out of the house, and he never lived at home again. My mother must have known how true that was, because they brought me in, and they made up some lie, you know how we do. And I don't know this, I got this secondhand from one of the people that brought me home, but they said, she looked right at him and said, listen, son, when the grass stains are on the tops of her tennis shoes, I know that's not how it happened. So, my mother hid me in my bedroom for 2.5 days, and eventually, when I wasn't getting better, she took me to the hospital, and I had a severe concussion. And I missed those debating championships. And even though I tell you it didn't mean anything to me, my debating partner and his stand-in both got scholarships to Stanford, and I was still at home. You know, so drinking was already interfering with life, and I didn't even know it. I was a blackout drinker by the time I got to college. By the time I got to college, I went up to Washington State, and by the time I got to college, actually, I went to that school on purpose. I don't know if anyone know about Washington State. Well, it's in the Palouse. It had a town of about 1,500 people, about 13,000 students, and it was the middle of nowhere. It was a land-grant school in a blue-law state, and I thought, maybe I'll graduate. And that was seriously why I picked it. That and my sister was going there, and I had no idea what I was doing in school, but I knew it was different than being at home. And so we both went up there. Once again, I was a great embarrassment to her. Joined a sorority, like I belonged in a sorority. Even today, it's hard for me to picture. and I was there. I can't help it if you can't relate. I can't either. I joined the sorority, and I knew I didn't fit in. It was just like every place else I'd ever been, and I was an embarrassment to them. And actually, they ended up asking me to leave. You know, there's certain things that I don't realize are part of the game. See, so one of the things that happened is all the guys used to come over, you know, and they'd do these raids, and they'd steal all the girls' panties. And so I went through the underground duct system, went into the guys' dorms, and stole all their panties. And I thought this was like equal rights. And they thought it was theft. And it's a pretty petty charge to go before the Board of Regents on. It's really embarrassing. If you're going to do that, you want to steal something a lot more important. So that was about the end of the happy sorority days. If I were to tell you about college, I would say, just like I said about high school, you know, it wasn't too bad. I did okay. The fact is, when I look back on it, my first suicide attempt was when I was a sophomore in college. And at that time, that's the first time I saw a therapist. And I remember waking up in the hospital after that suicide attempt. And I'd been in such a blackout when I tried to commit suicide that I didn't know why I tried to commit. They're all trying to get to the bottom of it. I haven't got a clue. That didn't slow me down. I just made something up. And so it was actually, I attempted suicide twice when I was in college. And the other time it was because a person I was in love with and thought I had a relationship with started dating a guy and getting married. Now, I had never told her we were having a relationship. She was at a little bit of a disadvantage. That was to be a pattern. You see, I had several relationships that never happened until I was 30. And I've never quite gotten to the bottom of that either. The first time that I got into real trouble, where I was in physical danger, happened in college, and it happened in a blackout. And I came out of a blackout about 5 miles out of town after being out with a guy I'd never been out with before, and I'd been beaten and raped and left out there. And I had so much pride because I thought I was so tough I wouldn't even tell anybody. You see, the embarrassment to me was that I wasn't tough enough to win, you see. And I still didn't relate that to drinking. eventually in one of those blackouts in college, I got pregnant. And I didn't know it for a long time since I hadn't known I'd done anything to get pregnant. And that's one of the disadvantages of blackout drinking. And so when I found out I was pregnant, you know, I was about 4.5 months pregnant, and everyone thought I might, not everyone, I only talked to the doctor, but you know, this is how I tell stories, they grow. I told the doctor, that was everyone. And he asked what I was going to do, and you know what I thought? I was so alone, and I was overjoyed. I thought, wow, finally someone to love me unconditionally. And I had some money that I saved because I planned a trip to Africa, and I worked a lot in the summers, and so I was always hardworking. And so I told my parents that I was at school, and I told everyone at school I was at home, and I moved to Seattle, and I got an apartment, and I started preparing to have unconditional love in my life. And in that apartment, I bought baby furniture, and I set it all up, and I bought baby clothes, and I was really nervous. And because I was nervous, I started drinking more than usual, and I started taking more medications than usual, and I started using some additional chemicals, and I was pretty well strung out by the time I had this baby. And it was not because I didn't care. Excuse me. It was not because I didn't care. It was because I cared so much. I didn't want to screw this up, my first big chance to bring an untainted soul into the world to love me. Now, the common denominator here is I haven't said once to you that this was something I could love unconditionally. My mind didn't work that way. And I went to the hospital to have that baby, and the baby was born very, very sick with some heart defects. And at that time, this was in the early 60s, and single women weren't encouraged to have births and keep babies and raise them alone, particularly single women like me. And so the nurse came in, and I still remember it. The nurse came in, and she said, listen, this baby's very, very sick. It's in the intensive care unit. And, you know, you're not equipped to keep that baby, and it's going to be very expensive, and it takes a lot more maturity than you have. And we have these papers right here, and if you'll just sign these papers and eat lunch, you can leave. And I looked at that, and it was all so overwhelming, and I signed those papers, and I ate lunch, and I got dressed, and I left. And I never shed a tear, and I never told a person, and I went back to that apartment, and I burned all those clothes, and I broke all that furniture. And I said, you know, I am never going to let anyone love me unconditionally again. And I went back to school, and I didn't date anymore, and I didn't do anything anymore. I ran 6 to 10 miles a day. I got straight A's. I was the model student, and I was getting even with a world that didn't even know they'd done anything to me. And I was still drinking every day. And I didn't think I did anything to my parents in that period of time, but, you know, all my parents wanted was to have someone in their family graduate from college. This education success thing was really a big deal to them. And I got even with them. I had to make amends for this later. Turned out I not only graduated, but even with all that going on in my life, I graduated second in my class and was supposed to lead in graduation. I was voted by my classmates. And I told my parents I wasn't going through graduation, and I didn't let them share in that. And even though I've made amends today, you know, at that time I didn't think I'd done anything wrong. I moved back to Chico after I graduated, moved back to my hometown, where shortly thereafter, you know, I still wanted to do this thing right. I still wanted to get my parents' approval that I'd never had, particularly my dad's. And it's been a mark of my life that until after I was sober, I never knew that my modus operandi was to pick out someone whose approval I could never, ever get and make that the only thing that counted to me. And that's where I was with my dad. So I was sitting in my house with my motorcycle in the living room, and you could see it out the picture window, and it was Halloween, and there was a knock on the door, and I opened the door, and this tall, dark, handsome man had a shot glass in one hand, and he said, trick or treat. I invited him in immediately. I found out that he was a character, and that he was like me, was a Jekyll and Hyde. I mean, here he was on Halloween having a great time, I later found out he wasn't very interested in me, but he was really attracted to the motorcycle. And he was in administration in Chico State, and I knew then I didn't love him, you know, but we turned out to be best friends, and one day he said, listen, he's quite a bit older than me, he said, listen, I'm middle-aged, I'm in an administration that's all Mormon, and it's really not very acceptable for me to not be married. Will you be my wife? And I thought, here's the answer to my parents' dreams. So it was the first in a series of poor selection criteria for relationships. We were married. And I didn't think he had a drinking problem because he didn't drink during the week, only when we went out of town and on weekends. And he was a true Jekyll and Hyde. But getting ahead was really important to him. And there were a few things about that marriage that I want to share with you, is that even though I wasn't in love with him, I planned on being married for the rest of my life, because that's how we were brought up in my family. And I thought if I tried hard enough, we could make this work. So after various drinking escapades, when he left me 5 years later, and it was really just because I embarrassed him out of that marriage, he wasn't much more interested in a relationship than I was. But I had just done things that were unacceptable. You know, we would be at the administrator's table at the Christmas feast, dressed in a formal, you know, playing the role. Now, at this time in this group, you might ask, well, you know, did she know then? Well, I played on a few softball teams. I'd met the gym teacher. So, you know, I knew, but I wanted to be acceptable, you know, so I kind of kept the softball separate from the marriage and went to the dinner. This was hard work for me, and it was part of that dual life. It was part of that dual life that alcohol masked for me. It was part of that same stone I had put in my heart when that baby died. You know, it was that I'm not going to feel, I'm not going to do, I'm going to march through life, and I'm going to win. But in order to do that, I took a flask with me to the dinner. And you know, those Mormons are sharp. When you're at the table putting out your cup, they get it right away. You know, and my stories got better, and I became more entertaining, and I really thought I was an asset to the group. My husband asked me to step outside, and he had gone outside, and he was in administration at the university, and he was actually the second highest paid guy there. And only he can tell you where our money went. But, because we never seemed to have any, but he was in a very respected position, you know, and here I was in his doing this thing to him and not thinking a thing of it. So he asked me outside, and he'd hired a cab, and he took me out, and he put me in a cab, and he gave the cab driver the keys to the house and some money, and he said, please take her home. You know, she's too much of an embarrassment to me. And the cab driver drove me home, put me in the house, locked the door. It was one of those kinds you could bolt from the outside then, and put the keys in the mailbox as he'd been instructed. You know, I stood in the middle of the living room, and I was all dressed up, and I really did look good. And I had long blonde hair then, and I had really made an effort. I even put on all the makeup and did the whole deal. And I stood in the middle of that living room, and I knew I'd blown it once again. And I had a moment of clarity. And I was, what's wrong with my personality? There's a problem with my personality. Never related it to alcohol. Not even for an instant. And so that man eventually left me. And what I did next is what our book talks about. I sought lower companions. We talked a little bit about it in the meeting today. But I sought lower companions. And I had my first relationship with a woman. Like a lot of first lesbian relationships, I was sure that was forever. It may have been sick, it may have been abusive, I may have been beaten, but it was mine. And I thought by seeking a lower companion, they would never leave me. I was safe. I would have unconditional love. Now, it didn't turn out a lot different than my marriage. In my marriage, there had been rules. You know, we had a lot of rules. Now, obviously, I broke some of those rules. One of our rules was whoever gets in bed last turns out the light. This is a rule. We don't break rules. So I'm laying in bed. My husband says, "You forgot to turn out the light." I said, "No, no. You forgot to turn out the light." He says, "No, no. You were in bed last. We have rules. You didn't turn out the light." I said, "I'm not turning out the light." He says, "Okay." He reaches in his bedside drawer, gets out his gun, and shoots out the light. These were the kind of relationships I had. And after that, I sought lower companions. So, anyway, I was in this abusive relationship, which I really didn't feel too bad about because I'll tell you the truth, that's all I thought I deserved. That was the kind of person I was. These were the kinds of people I attracted into my life. And I also wasn't sure that kind of a relationship was really okay with me. So while in that abusive relationship, I would occasionally sleep with men and try and prove that I was okay on the side. And I don't know if any of you have ever done that, but that kind of a double life helps plummet that alcoholism for me. And what that did for me is it told me that that I wasn't okay as a person. And I'll tell you what happened is that person did eventually leave me. I once again broke too many rules. You know, I was an embarrassment. I had rages that people would tell me about that I don't even remember. My impression of it was there was something terribly wrong with me because I was a pretty nice person during the day. And from what people say, I must have gone bad after dark. And I can't tell this part of my story very clearly because it's as it's reported by others. And what happened was is after this person left, I attempted to call on the phone and they wouldn't answer and they wouldn't answer and I drank more and more. And so I went over because I just wanted her to listen to me. You know how we never feel heard, we never feel understood. So it was 2:00 in the morning, time for understanding. And so I went over. I wasn't sure she would listen, so I took my 357. And I know that always helps them pay attention when I'm talking. So I'm not sure what happened after that, but when they arrested me, I was naked. They arrested me on a 5150. That's that mental kind of charge, you know, where you're a danger to yourself or others. I love groups like this. You know, you tell people not in AA about, you have to explain a 5150. Come here, they all go, "Yeah, I know what that is." Yeah, okay. So I was arrested on one of those, you know, and they put me in there and they said, "Were you drinking?" Now, I intuitively knew certain things. And one of the things I intuitively knew was if I said yes, they would think that was the reason. And you know as well as I know, if you were having a life like mine, that alcohol was the solution, not the problem. It was the only reason I could walk among all of you and not kill each and every one of you, most of whom deserved it most of the time. And so when they said, "Have you been drinking?" I said, "No. I was having a little problem with my personality." And so they kept me. And I lost my job. And that was the first time I'd lost a job. Now, I'd become less employable, so I had lots of jobs. But I really thought that they should have called me Justin because I always left them just in time. You know, when you get that feeling that it's time to move on, and that's usually just before you're fired. And I've also found as an alcoholic, and I've watched a lot of other alcoholics, so I think this is true of more people than me, we alcoholics don't have a lot of trouble finding jobs. We're not great at keeping them, but we can find a job most of the time. So I'd always found jobs. But after this happened to me, because of the kind of work I did, I had a very hard time finding a job. And what happened as part of the conditions of my probationary period was I was supposed to see a therapist twice a week. And this therapist was really, really kind to me, and I didn't want to waste his time. And I wasn't sure what had happened because I couldn't remember. So I made a few things up. I told lies. They believed the lies. They made diagnoses based on those lies. And I went out and lived the diagnosis. And that's how it worked. Within a short time, I had been diagnosed with a couple of mental illnesses. I had a personality disorder. We knew that. And I was bipolar. At that time, they called it manic depressive. And I was on 3 psychotropic drugs, you know. And I had lost most of my friends because they were afraid of me. They talked about these rages. I didn't understand. I didn't know what they were talking about. I tried to straighten out my life. I tried some controlled drinking. And I thought I was so successful at that my 20th year reunion was coming up. And I wanted to show how much better I was doing than at the 15-year reunion. These good ideas are usually a mistake. And I was in another relationship by that time, but I didn't take that relationship to the reunion, you know, because I was trying to impress them, not with my alternative lifestyle. And so I went to the reunion, and when two old friends of mine brought me home, my roommate's only comment was, well, where are her clothes? And they said, we don't know. She didn't have any when we found her. It was sort of a theme. I don't know what kept happening to my clothes. One of my worst fears of sobriety whenever I return to Chico is pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And now that I've told you about the good years of my drinking, I want to tell you what happened when the problems started. When I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought that I had had 23 years of successful drinking followed by an acute attack of alcoholism. Because in my opinion at that time, in my recollection, it had all gone to hell in the last 6 months. In that last 6 months, I had put myself in dangerous situations. I had been raped on more than one occasion. And I came in a consummate victim. I thought I was nuts. I'd been diagnosed. I was an identified patient. The world was taking advantage of me because I wasn't able to take care of myself. I had not put together, when you go into bars and leave bars with men you don't know who have guns and ride motorcycles, things don't always turn out well. I just didn't get it. And I was just trying to be okay. And basically, I thought I had a tragic story. Parts of my story were just plain insane. And I'm actually forced to tell you a story because I promised two people tonight that I would. And this story just epitomizes the insanity of my drinking. A few months before I quit drinking, the same roommate that had welcomed me home after the reunion was in the landscaping business. In the course of her work that day, she'd found a wounded bird. And so she brought this bird home, but she had two more accounts to do. Now, she didn't count on me doing much right. Okay, but she had two more accounts to do, and she said, Sonia, this bird's very sick. Bird's very important to me. What I'd like you to do is I'd like you to take care of this bird until I get home. And all you have to do is about every 20 minutes give it a few drops of water and make sure that it's okay. I said, no problem, I can do it, it's handled. You're covered. She leaves. I'm pretty nervous, this is a lot of responsibility for me. So I am so nervous that I go, and scotch was my drink of choice. I should have told you that a long time ago, but it doesn't matter, I would have drank anything, so it's the same story. I mixed a big tumbler of scotch, and I watched the bird and gave it a couple of drops of water. I'm having the scotch. The phone rings. You know, I had one of those portable phones, and it's not coming in too good in the house. And so I'm on the phone. I mix another drink, and I go outside on the patio, and I'm talking on the phone to hear it. You know how we are. I mean, half an hour, 45 minutes goes by. And I realize now I've left the sliding glass door open. So I go in the house just in time to hear from the kitchen where I had left the bird. I go, oh, my God. I race into the kitchen, and here's the cat licking his chops, sitting on the counter by where I had that bird, and I'm like, now this is denial. I pick up the handkerchief the bird was in, and I shake it. I set it down. I take everything off the counter. No bird. Okay? I shake it again. No bird. I thought, oh, my God. That cat. I look for the cat. The cat shoots outside. The cat knows alcoholic rage just immediately. I am so mad, I fix another drink. I go, I got to do something. This bird must be here somewhere. I look all over the kitchen for the bird. The bird is not in the kitchen. Acceptance is everything. I accept that the cat ate the bird. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, what am I going to tell her when she gets home? Well, what I got to do is make this right. So I get the 357, and I load it up, and I go out in the yard to look for the cat. Cats have a sixth sense. And so when I start looking for the cat, it gets pretty cagey, and I'm blasting shots. I live in a neighborhood. This isn't out in the country. So I'm blasting shots at the cat, and the cat's everywhere. They're screaming around, and I run out of bullets. Not to be deterred. The persistence of the alcoholic is amazing. I go back in and I want to load the gun because I need to do justice, you know. And I can't load the gun because I'm too drunk. But it's Friday night. And on Friday night in Chico downtown are the concerts in the park. I don't know if you have those here, but there's 400 or 500 people and they sit and listen to groups singing. They bring picnic baskets. It's kind of a neat thing. I didn't do it often. And so that's what you tell someone your town has when you're from there to impress them. You never attend. And so I know there will be someone I know there that will help me with this problem. And I'm too drunk to drive. Now I'm getting smarter, you know. So I get out my bicycle and I put the 357 in the basket and I take a sock full of bullets and I put them in the basket and I pedal 4.5 miles downtown. And I park the bike at the curb, and I take the 357 out of the basket, and I take the bullets, and I proceed to wander among the crowd to see who will load the gun. And who should appear but the very same woman from the relationship that I got the 5150. She says, Sonia, I haven't seen you in ages. Now, she didn't say you haven't changed a bit, but she says, what on earth are you doing? I said, well, you know, I got this cat. You know, I think I'm telling this story. And she says, listen, you know, you're in a bad spot here in this park with that gun and everything. Why don't you come with me? I'll help you out. So I come with her. We put my bicycle in her van. We put the gun in the van, bullets in the van, me in the van. And she takes me in the van to my house. She gets the 357. She loads it up for me and hands it back to me, lets me out of the car and says, go get him. I'm out there looking for that cat. And, man, this is hard work. I'm getting really tired. And I look for the cat, and I look for the cat. And eventually, I am too tired to do this. So I write this note to this woman. I said, dear Linda, I am very sorry that your cat... Oh, by the way, this was not my cat. This was her cat. I said, I'm very sorry that your cat ate your bird. And I know that the only right thing to do was to do justice to that cat. But I've chased that cat for 4 hours, and I'm very tired. I'm going to bed. Sorry. She was relieved. And it was just that I didn't see anything wrong with that picture. About 2 months after that, I thought, well, the problem really is, the real problem here is that people won't leave me alone. And it was a guy across the bridge, and he was working on a housing development. And so I went over, and there had been a truck that had gotten into an accident, and it had one of those big refrigeration units on the back. And they were selling it cheap, so I bought that refrigeration unit, and I had them bring it over to the house. And I went across the bridge, and I offered that guy a couple six-packs, and he dug a great big hole. Now, he dug the hole. I put footings in the hole. I put stuff all around the hole. And I had the other guy deliver the refrigeration unit and dump it in this hole. Now, this refrigeration unit's about 8 by 20. And then I got a cement truck. I had done some building, and I had him pour concrete steps down to this. I used 11 yards of concrete for this. Then I ran electricity into it. I put a steel door with a Schlage lock, and I bought cases of wine. Not cheap wine. I was an investor. I bought French wines, imported wines. The dollar was good against the franc. I had all this wine down there. And I put about 6 books down there in a chair. And I said, all right, I'm going to sit down here and sip my wine and read my book. And if the world leaves me alone, I'm going to be okay. About 2 months later, after I got sober about 2 months after that. And about 6 months after that, I had the first, my sponsor had me to ask me to have an AA event at the house. And people would say, what is that over there? It looks like a bomb shelter. I'd say, it's a root cellar. It had never seen a root in its life. And I guess the good part, here's how God works in my life. About 2 years after I got sober, I started a business. And the money I used to start the business came from the wine I sold out of that wine cellar. So you never know. But anyway, what happened? Well, what happened was that lover of mine went on a vacation. She was going back to New York. And I said, oh, great, when are we going? And she says, well, you're not going. You know, 3 of us are going. There's not room for you. Well, it was a big car. You know, it was like one of those big Plymouth Belvederes. So I'm not stupid. I said, why not? There's plenty of room for me. She said, because we need a vacation from your drinking. Well, for 23 years, drinking had been the solution, and I knew in my heart that I could quit drinking anytime I wanted. I had just never happened to want to yet. And so I said, I'm going to get even with her. I'm going to quit drinking while she's gone. I'm just done. That'll fix her. And so I quit drinking, and in about 2 days, I was really sick. And I started shaking, and I wasn't at all myself. But, you know, I was still on a softball team. I didn't want to let the girls down. So I went over to the softball diamond to play in the game, and I'm shaking. I can't even figure anything out. I'm sweating all over. And I was not inclined, like, to wet my pants when I was drinking, and it seemed to be happening since I quit. I mean, this just wasn't a good thing. And this woman said something I didn't like. The game hadn't even started. And I turned around in front of 200 people, and I decked her cold. And I was 40 years old, and I was just embarrassed to death. And I fled that softball field, and I went home, and I stood in the middle of my living room, and it was a lot like clear back during that marriage. And I said, you know, God help me. God help me. I don't know what's wrong with me. And I was so sick. You know, I am just so sick, and I don't know what's wrong. And about an hour and a half later, I thought, you know, that woman's been kind to me for a long time, and I should call her and apologize. And I called her on the phone, and I said, listen, Jan, I'm really sorry I hit you tonight. I said, I got to tell you, I'm having a little problem with my personality. And for some reason, God worked in my life, and I added, and I'm trying to quit drinking. She said, are you willing to go to any lengths? I should have known. I don't want to imply that I was self-centered, but I had been on the same teams with this woman for 6 years. I had been in her house. She had gently covered me with a blanket when I fell asleep at the end of many evenings, what we call passing out. I had never even noticed she wasn't drinking. And she said, I'll be right over. Now, it took her about 45 minutes to make a 5-minute drive, and I want to tell you why. I found out later that she'd been waiting so long for this moment that she sat down, she got out her big book, and she read the chapter on working with others just to make sure she didn't blow her big chance. And she came over, and she told me her story, and she sat with me. And I was really sick by then, and she offered to spend the night and take me to a meeting the next day. And I got up that next morning, or I tried to get up, and I said, you know, Jan, I believe I'm too sick to go to that meeting. I said, I can't go to that meeting. And she said, why not? I said, I'm too sick. And she knew enough to go into the kitchen and get me some scotch, and she gave me the last drink I've had between then and now so I could get well enough to go to that meeting. And I found out later that at the time she took me to my first meeting, she had 11 years sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she truly practiced a program of attraction. And So when I say I got to Alcoholics Anonymous by accident, that's what happened, accident and fright. I still didn't think I was an alcoholic, but I mean, after you deck someone and you tell them you're going to go to any lengths, you got to go to the meeting. That's just the way it is. I've got standards. So I went to the meeting, and I listened, and God, they were wonderful, and they made me feel welcome, and they filled up that hole in my heart. But, you know, I said to myself, well, I'm crazy, and they're alcoholics, and this probably won't work for me. But they kept telling me to come back, and so I did. And in my first 60 days, I went to 2 to 3 meetings a day in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I was too sick to drive to meetings for about the first 10 days, and I want to tell you what people did, because we don't do it often enough anymore, and I have to be reminded of it myself. I hadn't gone to a recovery center. I did have DTs. They did take me to the emergency room twice for seizures. I'd worked at the hospital, and the ER doc and I had worked a lot together, and he didn't want to really think they were alcoholic seizures, so he'd hydrate me and send me home. And those people had people come to my house and stay with me between meetings. They came an hour before the meeting and helped me shower. They took me to meetings. They read to me between meetings. And that was my start in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's pretty good for a woman that wasn't an alcoholic, who was just plain nuts. And you know, and I wasn't much of a woman when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, but it was all I could do just to get there 2 or 3 times a day. And at about 60 days, I decided Alcoholics Anonymous wasn't working for me. But there was one woman in there I particularly liked, and so I wanted to go tell her I was leaving Alcoholics Anonymous, but I still wanted to be friends. Well, I was humming and hawing for so long that she thought I was asking for a sponsor. So she says, it's okay, dear, some people are shy, I'll be your sponsor. And she put her arm around me, as they do, so you can't escape. That's what that's about. You think it's affection. They put their arm around you, and she says, why do you think this isn't working for you? I said, I'm just not getting this spiritual part of the program. I have no higher power. And she says, well, dear, sometimes if we also quit taking all the other chemicals, the spiritual part of the program works a little better. This is about alcohol, but I said, I don't have any other problems. She said, good, then it won't be a problem for you to quit. So I went through withdrawal again, and she had her other sponsees sit with me, if that wasn't a treat, and take me to meetings, and I began to work the steps. And I didn't think I could work the steps because I didn't have a higher power, because I quit believing in God the day that that baby died and the day my granddad died and the whole deal, and I just didn't think it was there for me. I knew there was a God, it just wasn't my God, and that wasn't near as big a problem as I had with the fact that there was not a power greater than myself. And so I tried to work the first 3 steps, and I heard that second step real clearly, that there might be a power that could restore me to sanity, but I seemed to be stuck. And I was still going to therapy twice a week, and I was taking all those psychotropic drugs. And when I first came in here, I used to say I was on 7 psychotropic drugs, if any of you have heard me a long time ago. And since then, I figured out I was only on 3, but I'd added 4 other things on my own, so it was sort of true. But I was only on 3 that were prescribed. And I continued taking that, but she had a suggestion. She said, you know, here in Alcoholics Anonymous, we try and live in the solution. And there's nothing wrong with therapy, but it's focused on the problem, and they're 2 different subjects. And this is just for me. It doesn't apply to you. So she said, what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to concentrate on the steps. And then when you've worked all the steps, you can certainly go back to therapy if you like. I said, if I quit going to therapy, I might be crazy. She said, that's okay. You won't be any crazier than you were before you started it. So I did that, you know, and I worked the steps. I thought I couldn't go past the 3rd step because I didn't have a higher power. And I am one of the people that got a higher power as a result of working these steps. And when I said the 3rd step prayer, I made a decision to turn my will and life over to the care of a loving God as I understand him, if he exists. And that's how I did it. And I worked the other steps, and I did the 4th and 5th step. And in the 4th and 5th step, I found a pattern in my life, and it was the first time in my life that I realized that as the victim, I had a part, that I put myself at the mercy of the universe when I took that first drink, that if I didn't take the first drink, the drink couldn't take me to all the bad things that happened next. And that was my part. And I had some other parts. And I decided not to be a victim anymore. And I got that pattern, but I didn't get much else after the fifth step, and I didn't get a lot better. And I felt gypped because everyone in Alcoholics Anonymous had talked about the fourth and fifth step and what a big deal it was and what a big relief it was when you got it done, and I didn't feel that relief. And I went back to that same sponsor, and I said, this isn't working. And she said, well, there's seven more steps, four of which are the continuous action steps, and we don't really get relief until we at least try and work the sixth and seventh step. And I had to take a look at my character defects. And for me, it was real simple. It was about not doing the things I wanted to do and doing the things I didn't want to do. And I was given a prayer to say that helped me a lot with that. And here it is. God, let others treat me tomorrow as I have treated them today. And that helped me a lot. And when I fixed to do something selfish and self-centered, when I was starting to think about what might hurt you, I had to think about me tomorrow. And even though I was still self-centered, it was progress for me. As part of my eighth and ninth step, I went up to Seattle and I did research on that child that would have been 19 years old. And I found out that that child died at 6 months of age. And I beat myself up a lot about that. And I had to pray to that higher power that I'd found and ask forgiveness. And I had found a higher power by then. And what I found out was that I was judging myself by the woman I was at that point in my sobriety. And the fact was that the woman I was at the time that happened was doing the very best she could. And I had to forgive myself. And that was such a freedom for me. I became comfortable with myself for the first time. When I came to AA, I was actually in almost all straight meetings. And I couldn't behave in gay and lesbian meetings. They were like a playground for me. And I became comfortable. I was able to have women friends that I wasn't hitting on all the time. I was able to have friendships. And I want to talk just a minute about that. I know I'm going to close in a few minutes. But I want to tell you about this because I think it's so important. I noticed you had a 13-step meeting today that a lot of people didn't need. And when I had about 4.5 months sobriety, I went to this woman who happened to be my sponsor, and I told her I was in love with her and I wanted to go to bed with her and all the rest of it. You know, I was doing this whole thing. I'd been working up to this for a while, but she wasn't getting it with the subtle approach. And so I did that, and she said, well, I'm flattered. You know, a lot of people, you know, feel very close to their sponsor, you know, because they've helped them out and everything, and you'll get over it. I said, no, I won't get over it, man. I'm in love. And she said, well, that's just too darn bad. She said, I have 8 years sobriety. I deserve the best in my life. You're sitting there. You haven't worked the steps. You don't do any service. You're carrying all the baggage you had when you came in here. Why on earth? She said, you may think I care about your sobriety, but talk about pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. You know, the kind of person, she said, you know, you're a beautiful person in the rough. And with a little work, you're going to deserve the very best. So I want to give you a little advice. Anybody that would go to bed with you right now isn't good enough for you. So she said, I said, so if I work the steps and I do everything right, then you'll go with me. She said, if you work the steps, if you're doing service, and if you're a good active member in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you have a year of sobriety, and you ask me out, I'll consider going on a date. And I continued to manipulate that situation until she finally said, you know, I care a lot about your sobriety and you're going to have to get another sponsor. Now, the best part about this was I never knew this woman was interested in me in the least because she had integrity, because she cared about her sobriety and my sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to tell you that today I've been with that woman 12 years. All right. And thanks. A monogamous relationship, and we've worked hard at having a healthy relationship, you know, and Thank God I waited. I was scared to death. It was a typical me. I was scared to death that if I waited, she might find somebody else, you know, but it all worked out. I want to tell you about the few of the other gifts I've been given in sobriety. In about 4 years sobriety, I had talked all the time I was drinking about going back to school. So actually, it wasn't at 4 years. It was about, I started talking about it again at 4 years. But when I had 7 years sobriety, I applied to go back to school. And I was scared to death, and I took classes. And I started out by taking one class, and, you know, just that one day at a time type deal. And the hardest part for me was filling out the application. After I got accepted and did the one class and everything, the reason I was in Reno for 26 weeks was I was doing the clinical rotations, and I received my clinical doctor of pharmacy last May and went through graduation. Thank you. I wasn't going to go through graduation. I thought I was too old, and my sponsor said, "Oh, honey, there'll be some woman sitting up there with a 20-year-old daughter, and you may be the only hope she ever sees." So I don't know what that's supposed to mean, but I went through it. I'm employable today. I have a terrific job. I work in healthcare. I was telling Patio earlier today that I just got a job as a regional manager for my healthcare organization last fall. It's the first time I've worked full-time in 9 years. That's kind of a new idea for me. Talk about one day at a time. Actually, I told my sponsor, I said, "You know, I don't think I can do this. I don't work full time." She says, "That's an old idea. You won't know till you try it out." So anyway, I'm doing that. And today, people tell me I'm doing a good job. And it's stuff I learned here. Everything I have today, I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. Before I did this, my partner and I, in that business that I started, we had a business that we just loved. And we had that business for 3 or 4 years. And we wrote 2 books together. We sold them in 45 states and 3 countries. We got to travel all over the United States. We got to go to AA meetings wherever we went. We have just a wonderful life up in Oregon. And the other thing I learned here is that I'm okay no matter what. When I had 5 years sobriety, I lost that business. And we went back to a simple life without all the goodies. And I was still okay. And we were still okay together. And so it hasn't all been perfect. And it's been life, you know. It has its good days and it has its bad days. But, you know, I just can't. I know I talked a long time. The problem is that I just want you to know how great it is. You know, I want you to know how much I love Alcoholics Anonymous and how much it's given to me. And I'll close with one of my favorite passages in the book because I think it sums it all up. "There is no more aloneness with that awful ache so deep in the heart of every alcoholic that nothing before could ever reach it. That ache is gone and never need return again. Now there's a sense of belonging, of being wanted and needed and loved. In return for a bottle and a hangover, we've been given the keys to the kingdom." Thank you for letting me share.